Welcome. In this lecture, we're going to be talking both about the importance of Greek drama for the development of Roman drama, and also about the very different functions that drama occupied in Greek and Roman society. And let me say right off that when we talk about Greek drama, we mean exclusively Athenian drama. No playwright from any other Greek-speaking community has left us a single surviving play. The three surviving tragic dramatists, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, were all Athenian, as were the two surviving comic dramatists, Aristophanes and Menander. That in itself is a pretty amazing fact, particularly since thousands upon thousands of plays were written in Greek by Greeks from many parts of the Mediterranean which have not survived. The origins of drama are very obscure, but they are probably connected with song and dance rituals. According to tradition, the first dramatist was an Athenian named Thespis, who flourished in the 530s BC, fully two centuries after the heyday of epic. It was Thespis who allegedly introduced the first actor, or protagonist, literally the first competitor. The protagonist was originally a member of the chorus who stepped outside the chorus and engaged in dialogue with it. Then a second actor, and later still a third, were introduced, and in the case of comedy, a fourth. There were two genres of Greek drama, tragedy and comedy. Greek tragedy was destined to have a brilliant future, and it still does to this day, being performed almost all over the world. Almost all of its plots are drawn from heroic myth, and frequently the gods appear, sometimes in the form of a deus ex machina, literally a god from the machine, a reference to the fact that the actor playing the god was sometimes suspended from a crane that was then swung above on stage. The chorus consisted of 12 or 15 people. Just 32 tragedies have come down to us. We have 7 out of a total of 73 by Aeschylus, 7 out of 123 by Sophocles, and 18 out of at least 92 by Euripides. All lived in the 5th century BC. The heyday of Greek tragedy lasted well under 100 years, in fact. And with the almost simultaneous deaths of Euripides and Sophocles in 406-405, the genre went into decline, even though Greeks were still writing tragedies as late as the 5th century AD. It's due in large part to the Romans that the 32 plays have survived. Although very few Romans probably attended plays in Greek, they certainly did read them and study them. And as we'll see in the lecture on education, the plays of Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides continued to be studied well into the Byzantine era. The story of Greek comedy is more complex than that of tragedy. Hellenistic scholars divided it into three phases: old, middle, and new. Its heyday lasted from about 500 BC to about 250 BC. Old comedy is conventionally identified as all the comedies that were produced in Athens in the 5th century, though the only ones that have come down to us are by Aristophanes. There were 4 actors and a chorus of 24. The chorus was extremely important, as indicated by the fact that it gave its name to many of the plays, such as Aristophanes' Birds, Clouds, Knights, Wasps, and so on. Old comedy was, by some standards of propriety, obscene, a word incidentally borrowed from Latin and previously taken over from the Greek, meaning things that should not be shown on the stage or the scene. The dramatis personae were portrayed in an almost permanent state of erection, a point that is emphasized by the fact that the actors, there were no actresses in the Greek world, wore huge artificial phalluses. The plots usually take as their starting point a contemporary situation like the Peloponnesian War, and then propose a fantastic solution, such as how to end it. In the case of the Lysistrata, the women will go on a sex strike, bringing the men to their knees, literally. Prominent public figures, such as Socrates and Euripides, appear as characters and are ridiculed, lending a satirical aspect to the comedy. The genre died out in the early decades of the 4th century and was not revived, largely because it had drawn its inspiration from Athens's contemporary political and social concerns, which instantaneously lost their relevance, though the plays continued to be studied for their poetry. Middle comedy is represented by Aristophanes' Plutos, or Wealth, dated 388, and by fragments and titles of lost plays. It is less focused on Athenian politics, and the chorus plays a much reduced role. Then, from the last quarter of the 4th century BC onwards, new comedy became all the rage. Its greatest exponent was the Athenian named Menander, who made his debut in 323 BC. It was new comedy that the Romans encountered and adapted. Its chief characteristics were the following. Number one, it focused upon the family. Number two, it gave a lot of prominence to romantic love. And number three, its plots were shaped around devices such as mistaken identity or the discovery of a long-lost child after the child has grown up. Number four, it used stereotypes such as the profligate but tender-hearted playboy's son, the cunning but masterful slave, the self-absorbed and greedy parasite, the vainglorious but dim-witted soldier, and the genial but gullible old man. So, how did the Romans initially acquire a taste, limited though it might have been, for drama? We can only very dimly perceive the answer to this question, though there are a lot of possibilities. First, in 364 BC, the Romans performed a dance that was intended to avert a plague, though this doesn't seem to have evolved into drama in the way that dance accompanied by a singer probably did in Athens. Secondly, there was a long-standing native Italian tradition of drama which may have inspired the Romans before they encountered Greek drama. We'll talk about that tradition later. Third, Romans travelling in southern Italy and Sicily may have attended performances of Greek plays, or at the very least, heard about them. Chief candidates are Tarentum and Syracuse, both of which had large theatres. Greek drama took particularly firm root in southern Italy and Sicily. Aeschylus had very close ties with Sicily and produced some of his plays there. Fourth, troops of Greek actors from Neapolis, modern Naples, may have visited Rome and given performances there. And fifth, Greeks may simply have brought copies of plays to Rome, which Greek-speaking slaves, say, interpreted for their Roman masters. Even so, drama never occupied a central place in Roman culture as it did in Greek culture. For the Athenians especially, the theatre was, in the words of Paul Cartledge, I quote, a mass social phenomenon considered too important to be left solely to theatrical specialists. What he means is that theatre drew from the resources of the entire community in a way that is unique in the history of drama. And by resources, I mean A, that a great deal of money was expended on putting on plays, and B, that a very large number of citizens were involved in the production of the plays in various ways. Plutarch, for instance, claims that the Athenian state spent more money in the 5th century BC on dramatic productions than it did on fighting the Persians and maintaining its maritime empire. Scholars have estimated that the city Dionysia, the major Athenian theatrical festival, which was held in March to April every year, would have required the participation of some 1,500 persons in total. In short, drama, both comedy and tragedy, was deeply embedded in the political and civic life of the community, which thus, in a sense, inspired both the subject matter and the structure of the plays. That's because Athens was a democracy where debate and theatricality were central to the political and legal process. Drama eventually spread all over the Greek-speaking world, so that a purpose-built theatre became an indispensable feature of every self-respecting Greek city. They were an essential feature of any well-appointed town. The Romans, by contrast, though they developed their own very lively theatrical tradition, never incorporated it into the lifeblood of their community. Nor did drama enjoy the same status or popularity that it did in the Greek world. It remained, even in its heyday, which was the first century BC, a somewhat peripheral cultural enterprise. Roman dramatists certainly didn't address the burning issues of the day as Greek dramatists in the heyday of the art form did. The explanation for this seems to be that the Romans were reluctant to expose their political divisions and controversies to the public gaze for fear that it would cause unrest. Thus, Roman drama demonstrates no attachment to the community at large. In fact, there are numerous scathing references to drama and to theatricals in Roman legal texts. Roman law sought to curb the disorderliness which drama was perceived to encourage in both actors and audiences. The Roman authorities were also fearful that a theatrical space might be used as a venue for fomenting political and social unrest. In 154 BC, the censors, that's two senior magistrates charged with supervising public morality, initially agreed to the construction of a stone theatre in Rome, but then the Senate raised objections and it was destroyed. Then in 115 BC, the Senate banned all dramatic performances in Rome. Rome did not acquire its first stone permanent theatre until 55 BC. It was Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, Pompey the Great, who took the initiative. His theatre had an estimated seating capacity of 10,000 and was attached to a large rectangular precinct. Incidentally, at the end of the porticus was the building where Caesar was assassinated on the Ides of March 44 BC. In fact, on that very day, a gladiatorial contest was taking place in the theatre, which interestingly suggests that Roman interest in the dramatic art had already begun to wane by this date. We can just imagine the theatrical authorities saying, oh, we can't put on another play, we never fill it, we need to get back those gladiators, they always get us a full house. The most celebrated Roman actor of all time was Quintus Roscius Gallus, a freedman who became a friend of the dictator Sulla and who eventually rose to the level of knight. In general, however, the Romans were disapproving of actors whom they repeatedly charged with moral laxity, licentia. In fact, when the emperor Caracalla passed his edict giving citizenship to all freeborn males living within the Roman Empire in AD 212, he made a point of stipulating that any citizen who entered the theatrical profession would be categorized as infames, without honor, and incur stiff legal penalties. Not surprisingly, the majority of actors, and quite likely too the majority of individuals in the entertainment industry overall, were Greek. So we can probably detect a certain degree of racial prejudice at work in the legislation, based on the belief that those who entered the profession were adept at lying and deceit. The two earliest Roman playwrights were Lucius Livius Andronicus and Gnaeus Naevius, whom we met in the last lecture. As well as composing epics, they also wrote both tragedies and comedies. They based their plays on Greek originals and adapted Greek meters. According to Varro, a writer of the 1st century BC, Livius produced a tragedy and a comedy at the Ludi Romani, the Roman Games, in 240 BC. They were allegedly the first plays ever produced in Rome. Only the titles of his plays are preserved, 3 in the case of comedy and 10 in the case of tragedy. Naivius also translated Greek dramas into Latin, though he may also have written some comedies that he set in Italy. We have the titles of 32 of his comedies and 6 of his tragedies. The first Latin poet to specialise in tragedy was Marcus Pacuvius, approximate dates 220 to 130 BC. Pacuvius was the nephew of Quintus Ennius, the author of the epic poem The Annales that we talked about previously. Small world, eh? He came from Brundisium, a Roman city on the Adriatic coast whose culture was much influenced by the Greeks of southern Italy. Cicero regarded Pacuvius as the greatest Roman tragedian of Republican date. We know the titles of 13 of his plays. The last Republican tragedian was Accius, 170 to 85 BC, a freedman from Umbria and the author of 46 plays. Accius is the only early Roman dramatist who does not seem to have had a Greek connection, though he was certainly influenced by Greek tragedy. He borrowed heavily from Euripides, though some of his plays were inspired by themes in Roman history. For instance, his Brutus dealt with events leading up to the expulsion of Rome's last king, Tarquin the Proud, at the instigation of Lucius Junius Brutus. In fact, one of the features of Roman tragedy, Republican and imperial, which distinguished it sharply from Greek tragedy, is the fact that it was often infused with a spirit of patriotism. With Accius's death, Roman Republican tragedy comes to an end, though we hear of several Romans who wrote tragedies in the Greek style for their own amusement. In fact, it seems to have been something of a literary rite of passage for an aspiring, ambitious Roman. Quintus Cicero, a brother of the orator Marcus Cicero, was so powerfully affected by the genre that he claimed that when he went to Athens and visited Colonus, a village on the outskirts of Athens where Sophocles sets his last play called Oedipus at Colonus, Oedipus appeared to him in a vision. As a young man, Julius Caesar wrote a tragedy about the Oedipus story, and Ovid wrote a tragedy called Medea, only 2 verses of which have survived. It's a very great loss. All that has survived of imperial tragedy are 9 tragedies by Lucius Annaeus Seneca, the younger Seneca, plus 1 other tragedy by an unknown author. Seneca was advisor to the Emperor Nero until the latter forced him to commit suicide in AD 65. A Hebrew inspiration, both from Euripides and Sophocles, though there are striking differences in Seneca's treatment of the same myths. First, his most memorable creations are pure monsters with few, if any, redeeming features. Take his Phaedra, which is based on Euripides' Hippolytus. In both Seneca and Euripides, Phaedra falls desperately in love with her stepson, whom she tries to seduce. But whereas in Euripides' play, Phaedra battles with her feelings, in Seneca's play, she is sexually voracious. Likewise, in Seneca, she is much more guilt-ridden when her ploy fails than she is in Euripides. She's a creature, in other words, of extremes. Second, Seneca's characters vent. As T.S. Eliot remarked, all the characters seem to speak with the same voice and at the top of it. Gentler emotions such as affection, compassion, and understanding are almost completely absent from their repertoire. And third, Seneca delights in macabre descriptions of appalling bloodthirstiness. In his Thyestes, a play that is inspired by one of the grisliest episodes in Greek mythology, Atreus, to get even with his brother Thyestes, makes him unsuspectingly eat his own son's flesh. After he's revealed the ingredients, Atreus proceeds to tell Thyestes and us in gory detail just how he prepared the feast. Yum, yum, yum. And so the play ends. Unlike in Greek tragedy, where there is usually some sort of resolution, Senecan drama offers not the slightest glimmer of hope for a better future. We don't know whether Seneca's plays were performed on the stage or they may just have been recited. We never hear of any performances. Yet whatever we may think about the limitations of Senecan tragedy, it was largely due to Seneca that the genre was revived in the Renaissance. Seneca's influence was foremost in both Elizabethan and Jacobean tragedy, because Greek tragedy was unknown in the 16th century and 17th century, except to a handful of scholars. Shakespeare was certainly familiar with his work, either directly or indirectly, and drew from it, most noticeably in Titus Andronicus, in which play too a father dines unsuspectingly on his son's flesh. Other plays where Seneca's influence on Shakespeare has been detected include Hamlet, Richard III, Macbeth, Othello, and King Lear. Let's turn next to Roman comedy. We don't know much about the origins of Roman comedy, though we can't entirely discount the possibility that it had its roots in the native Italian tradition to which I alluded earlier. One element of this tradition, which seems to have played an important part in the shaping of later Roman comedy, is the Fabula Atellana, the Atellan drama, which took its name from a city called Atella in Campania. Judging from the fragments that have survived, Atellani, to use the plural, were rather crude, low-life comedies set in Italian towns that provided a farcical picture of rural life. The only Roman comedies that have survived in their entirety, however, are the so-called Fabulae Palliatae, dramas in a Greek cloak or pallium. Palliatae represent an originally Greek art form that was adapted to the taste of a Roman audience and given a Roman context and setting. Greek elements include stereotypical character types, costumes, and meter. The principal meters were iambic and trochaic. The iamb is a foot consisting of short, long syllables, and the troche consists of long, short syllables. In addition, it seems that many, if not all, of the plots were adapted from Greek originals. I say it seems because we have so little of the Greek originals to go on. There are two Roman playwrights who wrote Palliatae and whose work has survived: Plautus, 254 to 184 BC, and Terence, 195 to 159 BC. Plays of Plautus happen to be the earliest Latin works in any genre to survive intact. There are 21 of them, and it seems they're all adaptations of Greek comedies. It used to be thought that Plautus slavishly copied from Greek originals, but the publication in 1968 of a papyrus containing lines from a play by Menander, which he adapted, indicates the contrary. Plautus's literary career peaked around the end of the Second Punic War in 201. This was a time of considerable hardship in Rome, and it's tempting to suggest that he intended his plays to provide his audience with a sense of escapism from the harsh realities of life. Certainly, the fantasy Greek settings would have contributed to that effect. Plautus's reputation is not of the highest today. The fact remains, however, that he was extremely successful in his day and has been pretty successful in later times too. His most recent success, so to speak, was Stephen Sondheim's A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which premiered on Broadway in 1962 and which draws from three of his plays. It ran for almost 1,000 performances and was made into a movie starring Zero Mostel. Terence, full name Publius Terentius Afer, lived a generation later than Plautus. He was an ex-slave. He may have come from Africa, from Carthage in fact, since Afer means African. Terence belonged to the circle of the Philhellene Publius Cornelius Scipio Aemilianus, the friend of Polybius. He wrote only six plays, all of which have survived. Terence seems to have kept rather closer to the spirit of the Greek originals on which he drew than Plautus. In fact, he seems to have been somewhat sensitive to the charge of plagiarism. In the prologue to his play called The Eunuch, Terence admits that he, I quote, first gave some offence when, in spite of his clever translation, his wretched workmanship transformed good Greek plays into bad Latin plays. However, we shouldn't ignore the possibility that Terence subtly parodied the Greek originals for ironic effect, poking fun at the plots and stereotypical characterizations. Neither the plays of Plautus nor of Terence were performed much from the time of Augustus onwards, though Terence continued to be studied and read. However, it is entirely due to them that Greek New Comedy entered the Western dramatic tradition. Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors, which draws from the plot of Plautus's The Menaechmi, or Brothers Menaechmus, with its emphasis upon mistaken identity and romantic love, is perhaps the classic example. Menander's plays had all disappeared by the 7th or 8th centuries AD, though a papyrus of one play, virtually complete, of the Discalus, or Bad-Tempered Man, came to light in the sands of Egypt in 1957. The place of drama within Greek and Roman society tells us a great deal about the contrasting values of the Greeks and Romans, their differing literary tastes, their diverging social and political concerns, and to some extent, their disparate levels of intellectual sophistication. I want to develop this idea a bit further by discussing some of the differences in theatre and in theatrical productions. First, both Greek tragedy and comedy assigned great importance to the chorus, which not only served to punctuate the intervals between scenes, but also, more importantly, took an active part in the unfolding of the plot. The Romans, by contrast, had no use for the chorus, which they saw as a distraction and irrelevance to the main action. They perhaps could not get into the large poetic structures of it as well. Second, there was a marked contrast in the physical appearance of the Greek and Roman theatre. The Greek theatre consisted of two elements, a circular or caestra or dancing space where all the action took place, and a tiered seating area known as the theatron or seeing space where the audience sat. The Roman theatre likewise consisted of two elements. In this case, however, there was a semicircular orchestra, which was used not for acting, but for seating for the elite, with an auditorium behind where the general audience sat, and two, a raised stage, situated close to the orchestra, which was fairly deep. And whereas the Greek theatre was open on all sides, the Roman theatre was entirely enclosed. Some Roman theatres, including the theatre at Pompeii, were roofed and would have had the feel very much of a modern theatre. The Greek theatre was, by contrast, very much part of the landscape, since it was literally carved out of the hillside. So the contrast between the two physical spaces could hardly have been more marked. Third, whereas Greek plays were performed without any dividing line between actors and audience, the Romans employed the device of a curtain to separate the two. The curtain was probably introduced towards the end of the 2nd century BC. So we see a theatrical tradition which has lasted for a very long time. Originally, it seems to have been raised out of a slot in the floor. Its purpose isn't clear, but it may have had something to do with mime, which, as we saw in an earlier lecture, was acted without words, probably to provide a decorated background to their movements. There's no getting away from the fact that Roman drama, to this day, both as a subject of scholarly research and in terms of modern-day productions of classical plays, exists very much in the shadow of Greek drama. No one could seriously put forward the claim that Roman drama ever achieved parity with Greek drama in terms of quality, let alone originality. Certainly, the Romans never produced any tragedies even remotely comparable in stature to the Oresteia of Aeschylus, or to the Oedipus or Antigone of Sophocles, or to the Medea or Bacchae of Euripides. One might perhaps make the claim that the comedies of Terence and Plautus are world-class, though we would also have to admit that they were very dependent on lost Greek originals. Nor did the Romans produce a playwright remotely comparable to Aristophanes, the author of such outrageous and uproarious fantasies as the Lysistrata, the Clouds, the Frogs, and the Birds. To conclude, though Roman drama was highly derivative of Greek drama, it also differed from it markedly, as in the fact that it never played a role in the shaping of community values as it did in the Greek world. Nor did the Romans ever fully overcome their suspicions of actors. At the same time, it was Roman tragedy and comedy that provided the means through which the spirit of Greek tragedy and comedy was transmitted and kept alive in the Renaissance. And that represents a very significant gift to Western culture. In the next lecture, we're going to examine four other literary genres that the Romans took over and developed: love poetry, satire, history, and the novel. As with epic and drama, the study of these genres is interesting not only from the literary standpoint, but also because they shed a fascinating light on differences in attitude of the two peoples towards the human condition.